Hey guys, Mimuna here. I'm going to pop in and make two comments before this episode airs. In all honesty, Hannah and I are a little nervous about this episode. This topic is so sensitive right now, and we have processed so much since the episode, and it's such a just a snapshot in time of how we feel in the moment, what we're processing in the moment, and sometimes that can feel very restricting and limiting. So we wanted to at least make these two comments. Number one, a friend of mine on social media made this comment about how people judge Black anger. People judge the reaction to George Floyd's death, and sometimes with protesting, sometimes with rioting, and people really don't recognize that the road to freedom, this was her quote, has never been pretty nor has it been paved. That was Zainab Adin, my friend. And she was actually referring to, look, people, Harriet Tubman carried a gun not only to fight anyone who captured her, but for the slave that freaked out and decided to turn back. She wasn't in the habit of making empty threats. The fact that she could shoot her own in order to protect the freedom of the rest of the people that were running away. And Zainab Adin, I'm shouting you out here. That was your comment. And that is so true. And we both recognize that. What we would like you to keep in mind as we are discussing the topic of shame and in this whole movement and in being anti-racist and sometimes speaking to people that are ignorant or misinformed, we are speaking from the perspective of our roles as people who hold space for healing. And I think that even though my sister and I's boundaries are a little bit different, that just please keep that in mind. We recognize we absolutely need the Harriets and the Malcolm X's and the Muhammad Ali's of this movement. And we also recognize that each person needs to be dynamic and respond accordingly. And that's really important. But just please keep in mind, we're speaking to our roles and not suggesting that everyone needs to tote this line or even have this conversation. The second point we wanted to put out there was listening back and editing this, we would go in and out of including ourselves as Black Americans and then speaking about the Black American experience that doesn't include the African diaspora. And listening back, it's if you don't know the sensitivity here, it might not even be a thing. But we wanted to, for our African American listeners, for our Black American listeners, we wanted to point out we recognize that there's racism within the African diaspora towards Black Americans. But we also, something that we have been processing right now in this particular moment, is the real spectrum of experiences when it comes to the Black American experience in general, right? The diversity in that spectrum. And we really wanted to be mindful and respect that African Americans have a different level of generational trauma than we do. They have a different level of also generational wisdom and awareness of what it means to be Black in America than we do. And so this is why we're coming in and out of that African American identity. For people who don't know us personally, we didn't want to, you know, be hurtful or dismissive or just like not mindful of the fact that there can be racism from Africans, and that this is not in an effort to distance ourselves from or try to be better than or anything like that.
You're listening to the Bold True Life podcast with Hannah and Maimuna. We're sisters, life coaches, and we have honest conversations about what it takes to blaze your own trail in life.
This means we'll be talking about the triumphs and the struggles of showing up to our lives with authenticity, courage, and mindfulness. We hope you enjoy the episode. Hey guys, welcome to the Bold True Life podcast. This is Hannah.
And this is Maimuna.
And today we are going to be talking a little bit about what's been going on in the U.S. lately since the death of George Floyd and how the Black Lives Matter movement has
sort of risen into the headspace of just about everybody right now. So it's been an intense year altogether, but the last couple of weeks have certainly been really eye-opening for me personally, and I think for you too, Moni.
Yeah, there's been a lot of processing. And now let's just take a step back and talk about some of the emotions and the struggles. What's been going on for you? How has this landed?
That's a good question. You know, it's having sort of the backdrop of the coronavirus and being at home constantly and already being in this like intense space. And then
why intense? Can you remind our listeners why things are intense for you right now?
For me personally?
Yeah.
I think in general things were intense for everybody, but for me personally, I'm also currently pregnant. And so just sort of navigating, you know, that and all of the fear and the, you know, there was just a lot to sort through, and suddenly adjusting to life being very, very different from what any of us were used to, being at home a lot more. And then on top of that, then we're seeing back to back to back, you know, all of these deaths of Black men and women. There was, you know, Ahmaud Arbery, there was Breonna Taylor, and then George Floyd. And it's just sort of all, you know, this was happening for so long and it was being recorded for so many years now. But for some reason, these particular deaths sparked something that we've never seen before in our generation, I should say.
Yeah. I think even older people are talking about how this feels different. Now, so just to give you guys a perspective of who we are, our parents are Ethiopian. I was born in Ethiopia. Hannah was born here in the U.S. And I think we grew up very insulated with our Muslim Ethiopian, other Muslim community. So of course we feel otherwise. Of course we've had discrimination. Of course we've had people, especially wearing hijab, just really ignorant comments. But this has been such a learning curve for both of us. And I have to say, for me, being married to an African-American Black man from LA, you know, these conversations have been, this education has been happening for a long time on my end. But it just clicked in a way that never clicked before this time around. The differences, the generational trauma, and I think that's partly what I was struggling with, is like, I have a 16-year-old who's about to get his license. And my experiences with the cops are very different from my husband's experiences with the cops. And I just like adjusting to the fact that my son, just by being a Black man, seeing George Floyd die, even when he was not being threatening, even when he was cooperating, that shook everyone, I think. Because what do you tell your kids?
Yeah. I think where you are particularly in that space of, you do have a son who's about to really be out in the world in a way that he's never been before. As he grows up, it's not just driving, but it's like he's about to start his whole life. And I think up until this point, it was easier to protect him from a lot of this stuff. Suddenly you're not going to be there every time something happens, or able to remind him. And even the fact that, kind of like us, he grew up a bit sheltered and didn't necessarily see all of the things that his dad saw.
Right.
So there's more, you know, it's going to be a learning curve for him too. And there's probably going to be a lot of shocking experiences and incidents along the way.
Yeah. I think that was definitely my experience too, like the brunt of discrimination, the brunt of like being held, not held back, but like where I felt it was more in my adult life. Running a business, you see a lot of Black businesses, Black people support, but it's with white businesses, I think a lot of white businesswomen get a diverse group of people who follow them. not necessarily something that people realize they're doing, but it's definitely, I've seen that happen with me, kind of people trying to put me, quote unquote, in my place. Definitely he's just going to have to live it. Yeah. It's in that sense, that's been a struggle for sure.
Yeah. It's also, you know, I'm in a much, much different phase of parenthood. I, you know, haven't even given birth yet. But it's interesting now that I know we're having a son. It's a very scary time in the world for many reasons, I think. It's strange thinking about it from the perspective of having another life in your hands too, or as it being responsible for another life.
Yeah.
It's almost easier to go through life before that period.
Motherhood brings a different intensity, sadness, scariness to this whole thing. Right? It just really does make a difference. I think a lot of people are feeling anxious, black or white. There's just been a lot of tension. But I'm going to take this conversation into a little bit of a different direction. We're probably going to pivot quite a few times today because there's a couple of things I want to talk about. Number one, I think I was telling you, I've been like randomly having arguments with people on the internets. right? Like I have been glued to social media. I have been, and this is just not who I am. I don't pick fights. I don't start anything. I don't even clap back. Usually being a coach, you're like, have empathy, understand all the different traumas that other people are, you know, like you just have that. And I have no room, and I'm finding that I'm very sensitive. And you've said you're just in a different place.
Yeah. I think two things are going on for me here. One, I've been a bit plugged into the world of Black activists and following quite a few of them for the last 2 or 3 years. The conversation didn't feel that new, but it just suddenly felt a lot more real. And then, you know, after a couple of days of seeing all of the conversations going on online, I just realized it was too much for me. I needed a break. So I've been quite limited with the amount of social media time that I've been spending and taking in. And I think it's a mixed bag, the pregnancy and just feeling in general more emotional than I typically would be. And also things feel hopeless and hopeful in a weird way all at the same time. Hopeful that, you know, change could really come from all of this and the way people are coming together and having these conversations. And I realized the work that I need to be doing right now is not on the internet. I just need to be participating in a way that feels more hopeful to me versus like just all the ignorance that the internet holds.
Right.
So donating to the different causes, having conversations with my own community, with my own people, you know, outside of social media, those are the things that feel productive to me right now. Being online was just, it just felt draining more than anything else.
Yeah. I remember you saying like, there's a need to like mama bear protect your energy right now. And I feel like that's absolutely where you need to be. Yeah. That I think in that sense, something that I've been processing is like, what is my role in all of this? Right? What do we need to be doing? And for you, I feel like you need to be talking to people who are not necessarily of different mindsets, right? Like-minded people, and furthering the cause in that way. We've done a healing circle around this, and I felt very compelled to be in a space where it's okay to be controversial. This has been, that's been a lesson for me, because I think we came into this and we had this conversation before on another podcast. We came into this just very aware of what happens when someone is shamed in general, right? That's something that we study. That's something that we work on with clients. And you know that you know that part of the brain shuts down when someone is shamed. They cannot hear what you're saying. They can hear you, but they will not understand you. So mm-hmm. I've heard a lot of people need to do their own research. The information is out there. At this point, if they don't know, they're responsible, right? And they can't even begin to process it. And so I've come from that perspective of always like, okay, I know that I can offer this space for people, but I've also felt like the emotional, my own story has gotten in the way of that. And I don't feel apologetic for that at all anymore. That's been a lesson. Like shame in my world and having shame, it's always been an obstacle to move around, work around. And now it feels like you are guilty, especially if you're white until proven innocent. Now I'm realizing the collective shame is not necessarily a bad thing.
Mm.
It's moving and shaking people to be aware, right? The collective, yeah. This has reached a fever pitch, and I don't think you should shame someone on purpose to get a result. I think that's manipulative. But I've been thinking about that a lot. The fact that we are kind of seeing our ignorance and our sins and our complicitness, and I say we because I think I'm a part of this,
up front. Yeah, definitely. Both of
right?
us.
it's necessary. Not only is it necessary, it's in the space where there's no justice, there's no rule of law, where people are held accountable for what they're doing. Yeah, shame is a good tool, you know? And I feel like that's been really liberating. And at the same time, realizing that people don't process things unless that becomes part of their story. And then if you give them a safe space, that's great. But sometimes you just don't even engage in the story until something is in your face. And I know that that's been true for me.
Mm.
I've been processing a lot of things because can you believe so-and-so said X, Y, and Z, and I have to go off on the side and like manage that and then come back and then work out my stuff. Yeah. And I'm like, I'm not processing this stuff unless it has something to do directly with me.
And I think that is, you know, this particular work feels new to us, but that
right.
is the emotional labor that Black people have been doing, Black Americans, I should say,
right.
have been doing since forever, making themselves fit in to a mold so that other people are comfortable versus the other way around. And now that particularly white people are uncomfortable, it's suddenly a huge shift in dynamic. And I think people are waking up, but at the same time, the fact that it's so uncomfortable is sort of making people want to run and hide when they can. But that in and of itself is a privilege too.
And I think that's what people are not tolerating anymore. Like you can I will come after you and bring this topic up. That's what's been happening in my private life. Yeah. I will bring this up every single time you say something that is problematic. And it's not, I've been learning that, you know, I've got to do my own work off onto the side because what is productive in the end of the day? They don't engage these issues unless they've said, one pattern that I've seen is I bring something up and I don't accuse. I go, this, what you said has made me feel uncomfortable. And here's why I feel uncomfortable. And then there's not been one person that has not replied with some form of, I promise I am not racist. And here's why.
Mm.
And even if they're saying like really classic things, like I don't see color and I have Black friends and I talk about these issues, and it just depends. Like some people I don't bother with. Like if I don't trust you, I don't bother having this conversation with you. That's where I've learned to draw the line. But for people I trust, I'm like, I trust you and you're saying these things. I wonder what this is, what is happening now? You know, like what is happening?
Hmm.
I'm realizing they haven't processed this because it's not their story. So this pattern just has to happen. So the pattern is you bring something up and they go, I promise I'm not racist because X, Y, and Z. And inevitably they say something in that whole spiel that is also problematic. And so the question is, like, what does it mean to be racist? And something that I've been listening to, I know I'm talking a lot, Hannah, so jump in anytime you want. But is, I know you were reading this book too about being an anti-racist with Ibram Kendi.
Yeah, I just started, so you might be a little further along than I am now.
I'm probably not. But I think what's been really clear is that there is no neutral territory. That concept of, I promise I'm not racist, like the way he talks about it is pretty profound, because in our work, there's always a spectrum, right? And when he said, you're either a racist or an anti-racist, I was like, huh, what is that supposed to mean? In any given moment, black, white, doesn't matter. You have these implicit biases that play a role, and they affect, at the end of the day, policy. And so you're either complicit and not working around that, or you are working on it. And you can have racist moments. And that's kind of been the conversation that I've been having. I'm like, yes, your intentions are there. You're well-meaning, but you just had a moment. And for myself too, I've been able to forgive myself for some things, because I was like, okay, well, that was a moment. Mm-hmm. So it's a lot of energy. It's a lot of energy, but it's necessary at the end of the day. And it's like, you have to be a therapist. You have to be an educator. Mm-hmm. These professions, Van Jones said it best, like, people, you get paid to be a professor. You get paid to be a teacher. I know I'm a coach. I get paid to be a coach. And so that's just been an interesting shift for me.
Yeah. So we both first came across the author of this book through Brené Brown's podcast when she had a conversation with him. And that was a really, really, you know, to that exact point that you made about the what exactly it means to be either an anti-racist or a racist. And the fact that in any given moment, you could be one or the other. You know, it's not like I'm always one or I'm always the other. You know, it's just the nature of this work. And the more aware you become, the less of those racist moments you will have.
Right.
But it's also, you know, as I was listening to you talk earlier a little bit about just the conversations you've been having, and specifically when you were saying, you know, you're only really having those conversations with people that you trust. I think that's a really important point to keep in mind, you know, having a boundary around that, because this work is really, it's endless if you don't have some sort of boundaries. And what I'm realizing is, especially for Black Americans right now, this is kind of the peak of all the trauma that's happened for the last 400 plus years in this country. Yeah. So this is really not the time to expect anybody to be educating us or taking the time to do that emotional labor right now. There are, like, really, I know you said it earlier, and it's this will not work for everybody, but there really is a lot of information out there. There's lots of books, there's tons of interviews. And right now, that's the best avenue for me to take, because I recognize that, one, I want to protect my energy, but I also really am like, I want to protect the energy of all those people who have put that work out too. Like, I don't want to take any more from them.
Right. Because that's a really good point.
They've put it out there already. They've done it and done it and done it. And why, you know, I understand for some people it's really, you know, suddenly this is a much bigger wake up call for some than it is for others. Mm. But at the same time, the expectation that, well, okay, now I'm here, so I need you to do this work again for me. Right. That is a privilege.
Right. I 100% agree. And I think people have to recognize, like, this is what we were talking about earlier. Where is your role? Where is your role? Some people are going to be activists, and they're going to be out there, and they're going to be doing policy work. What's your lane? And I think a lot of people are asking themselves that question, because you can't do it all, really. And I think right now, this is like corporate America. Every Black person has been asked for their input, and it's great and it's forward moving. But I think one thing that I'd love to keep in mind is that inevitably, once you start this work, people are going to step in it. And for Black people, they need a safe place to process.
Yeah.
All of that stuff and all of the trauma that gets re-triggered over and over and over and over again. What we're realizing, Hannah and I, more and more, is that we want to provide those safe havens for people, whether they're white or Black or a person of color who's not Black. I think that's where we do a really good job.
Yeah, I think right now the work, like you were saying, this work of processing, it's going to look different for each of us, right? Because we all came in from different places, different perspectives. And for some people, that means like suddenly doing a lot of learning. For others, that means resting, like just really taking a huge rest right now, because it's just so much to take in and to absorb, and to, you know, it's very traumatic to watch people die over and over and over again, to grow up hearing stories of people dying over and over and over again, and then to see it before your, it's just a lot, you know?
Yeah.
Especially when it's your own people.
Yeah. And I think, you know, when we say rest, there's a lot of deep work in rest. There's a lot of healing to be had in rest, even though quote unquote resting, taking a break from the craziness, it's actually very worthwhile.
Yeah. I, a couple of weeks ago, was listening to one of our previous podcast guests, Angelica Ali, or the Village Auntie. She went live on Instagram, but she was talking about how, you know, so many people have been reaching out to her to come and speak and share, you know, different experiences and teach, essentially. And I think a lot of particularly prominent Black women are probably being reached out to so much more suddenly than they were in the past. And she was saying, you know, it's right now is like, it's just too much to be in that space. And even while she's resting, like she was listing some of the things that are going through her mind, even while resting, it's like, that question of, are my children safe right now? Are we going to be okay? Am I safe as I'm driving to work? Am I safe as I'm sitting at work? Are my kids okay while I'm away from them right now? Rest is not the same for everybody at the end of the day.
Right.
Yeah. You know, it's like you're processing a lot as you rest. But you know, it's interesting. One of the things that I've been seeing a lot on social media, people saying that these conversations that are suddenly happening make them feel unsafe. And it's interesting because there's even to that, the spectrum of safety, right? Mm. There's like literally unsafe and then just
like emotionally unsafe.
Unsafe.
Yeah.
And
that's what I'm saying. You are, the shame is real and it's pretty necessary. So welcome.
Exactly. And I think it's just like, okay, like really, really think about that statement, right? Or think about that feeling. Yeah. Like, how unsafe am I really right now? What is the danger here? What will happen if I go there and have this conversation? What am I really afraid of?
And I have to say something to this because, again, this is where story really makes a difference. I've had two women say that to me, and that they came in with all the right intentions. One of them actually reached out to a friend to see how she was doing in all of this. Mm. And then some things, and she's like, I got my head bitten off. Mm. And so she's like, it's a confusing, in the defense of, I can't believe I'm saying this right now, but in the defense of this woman, she was like, I really meant to do the right thing. You know, and this is kind of like what they say, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Mm. And then she got the frustration of this woman and she was coming to me saying, I said all these things and what just happened? And I think it's really easy for us to kind of
this is a topic that I've been struggling with. It's like, I realize this is a dance. You get shamed. It's not necessarily a healthy thing if you get stuck there. That's a danger. That is a real danger, that we are going to get more and more polarized. And because people have these experiences, they will not come back to the table. But if they have a safe Black friend, if they have a safe place to be, if they have some of these people who are bridges, then the conversation can move forward.
Yeah.
Because they do not engage at all in the topic of racism until something like that happens. They don't engage.
Yeah.
It's not about them. So there's no reason to engage. And I think we can't be judgmental about that. Like, it's not relevant until it's relevant. And then once it hits, if they're so deep in shame, they go nowhere with it, then that's actually a loss for us. But if we can have a productive conversation, then that's a win for all of us, right? And I, this is the same thing that it drove me insane when people kept saying, but the looting, but the rioting. And everybody felt like, you know, you have nothing to say when it comes to murder. And then you have something to say when it comes to looting. I don't know what to tell you. That's infuriating. That's infuriating. But that's the reality. Like, it's not scary until it's in your backyard.
And to your point about the the need for those conversations and the safe spaces to have them, yes. And
yeah,
it's not your Black friend's responsibility. Yeah, it's not exactly. Your Black friend's responsibility to hold that space for you. It's not
right.
You know, they've been living in their Black body their whole 100%. Life, dealing with this stuff their whole life, and it's 100%. Not their job to be there and support you right now. Where were you? Were you supporting them through their all of those moments in the past years?
Right.
Were you there for them? Maybe you were, but were you really there for them in the way you expect them to be there for you right now?
I think that people would literally say, yes, I was. Yeah. And it's the ignorance that we are fighting. I really think they think, yes, they were. And I think it's dangerous to paint a very polarizing picture.
Yes, and.
Yes, and. I know, like, I know. Comes, and I want to argue comes, with myself. Yeah.
When it comes to that too, I feel like, okay, yes, it's not necessarily your Black friend's responsibility, but here's the thing. There are resources and people out there doing that specific work where you can actually go and learn these things from them, because that is what they have set their priority as. So
100%. And I will tell you this, this is an argument that I've been having in my head back and forth. This is the exact thing that I've been dealing with in my own head. Yes. And information doesn't equal understanding.
It not necessarily, but there are communities and quote unquote safe spaces that exist to have these conversations.
This is a conversation.
Go out of your way and insert yourself into those communities and join them. But it's not that they don't exist.
No, they don't. Exactly. But why would I join them? Why would I join them if I have shame? Shame is one of those things that you can't even point to. Like, if somebody says you have shame around this, they wouldn't even know it. You just know that you're avoiding something. And we've all done this in our past, where we've avoided, didn't necessarily know we're avoiding, but at some point it becomes part of our, you know, awareness. But in order to confront it, you need a safe space. And this is exactly what I've been grappling with. Like, it's not your Black friend's job. Absolutely. They need their own safe spaces. Forget it.
Yeah.
We need our own safe spaces. I need to process stuff. Like, I haven't been able to be there for people 100%. Absolutely not. I have to go off on the side and process stuff through my own story and then come back to the table, you know? So it's not your Black friend's job, 100%. And the need doesn't equal you're going to get it. You're going to have to kind of pull yourself by the bootstraps and get a little bit of information on your own, 100%. And as people of color and as Black people and as allies, if you're white, what is the best way? How can we be most productive with people? And I think if we don't understand the shame equation,
there's a price to pay, you know, that's the bottom line. We're just going to get more polarized.
I guess be that as it may, I feel like at this point in time, it's just the expectation
100%
is unfair, you know, or even the ask. It's just, it's like watching somebody drowning and asking them, hey, can you help me? It's like, it's just silly. Like, would you do that to somebody who is like clearly in dire need, you know? And this, I think, has been like an invisible trauma for so long in so many people's eyes, that now that they're seeing it, it's like, oh my goodness, I can't believe I haven't seen it all this time. But then we're still not seeing it completely.
Right.
We just don't have the same experience as Black Americans when it comes down to it.
Yeah. And, you know, for me, I think one of the moments of this whole thing that really hit me was when my sister-in-law had posted online, as many people have been posting, this question. And it was, when was the first time you got a gun pulled on you by a cop? And you just read those comments and you recognize, oh, I've been living in a completely different space. I'm in a different world. Yeah. Because this is just my friend group. And this is who, like, all of these crazy answers. And I went back to my husband, Skia, and asked him, I was like, hey, did you see her post? And I just wanted to start a conversation. He was like reminiscing on his own experiences. And he was like, recognizing himself, like he knows his own story and I know his stories, but putting it in a string like that, he's like, it must have been 3 times. And he's recognizing the first time that it happened, well, damn, I was just 11 or 12, you know?
Yeah.
And I was like, wait, what? How is that possible? Like, he was a small kid pulling a gun on an 11-year-old.
Yeah.
And then, like, the second time it happened, he was 16. And him and his brother, it actually happened to them together. They were at a bank withdrawing some money. Their mom was in the car. And they walk out, and all of a sudden, there's cops swarming them. It's like the way he explains it, it's like the SWAT team. Hands up, and they slam him against a car, and he's like thinking, these cops are trigger happy, like no good things happen with Black people and cops, you know, in LA, especially in that time. And it's a scary thing, right? And he's like, this, what just happened? And they're like, oh, you guys fit the description for bank robbers. And it's like, we were just in this bank, it didn't get robbed, right? And they figured the white teller woman, of course, presses a button because she freaks out because there's these two Black boys coming towards her. And then the third time, he was just at school and it was one of the school cops who picked a fight for no reason. And you just kind of string these things along and you're like, well, oh, you know, the trauma is coming right back up. And I feel like that is the exact reason. I think this is just processing for me as well. Like, I do well providing safe spaces for people to process their stuff.
Mm.
Right? So if Black people are able to process their trauma, then they're able to be more productive. So I'm not suggesting to ask that of your, to expect that. That's not what I'm suggesting. But I'm realizing this is my role, and I think you understand that as your role as well. Mm. Like, this is a lane, and this is the place that I can play. And yeah. For me, it doesn't matter if I'm dealing with an ally, if I'm dealing with a Black person. I've needed it myself. I've had people that I run to when, you know, Karen, the online Karen bothers me. And it's just that we don't process any of this stuff until we're engaged in our own story. And it just needs to happen for everybody. So, yes, and this has been the big kind of question that we've been grappling with.
Yeah, it's It's interesting. I think when it comes down to it, like we've been saying, really, yeah, the processing piece, and you're absolutely right. I think that is something that us being in the space that we're in right now, we do have the capacity to a degree to hold those spaces for processing specifically. And I think, you know, even you and I are probably at kind of different levels of availability when it comes to that.
Right.
But yeah, holding those safe spaces, it needs to be done for everybody, not just for people who are awakening in this moment. And I think right now, like what I'm realizing is, you know, it's interesting, and maybe it's just where each of us sees our role, like you were saying. But the people that I really want to be serving and servicing right now are those who've been in it for a while and are just tired. I'm here for you either way, but I just feel like, you know, you go to a hospital and there's like the triage, the idea of triage, right?
Right.
You treat the people who need it the most first. You're not going to treat the one who has a paper cut before you treat the one who got their leg severed off.
I love it. That is such a good analogy. Yes, 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 and yes.
So at the end of the day, I think I will always be there for the one who needs it the most, particularly the processing and the healing journey. We're all in different places, but I think, you know, part of this work for everybody is to recognize where are you and take ownership of that. You just have to take that ownership.
Yeah.
Nobody else can do that piece for you.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think I just bring this up because I think in activist work, you know, we are just tired. And I say we in the sense of like just people who have to listen to these stories over and over again. And it's just like, sometimes it's easier to clap back and be done. And the hard work is to sit back and to listen to people process and then to, you know, slowly have this back and forth. And you're right. Like, I'm not interested in having an argument with someone who's just closed off. Like, I'm not wasting my breath on that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think you're right. We're just probably in different places. And the triage point is a good one. It's a really good one. I did want to end with this. Do you have any last thoughts?
No, I don't. Okay. Other than, you know, I guess, you know, wherever you are, keep paying attention. What's going on for you? What do you need in this moment? And if you're feeling uncomfortable or afraid, questioning why that is and really, you know, just examining a little bit more, you know, what's really there. There's so many different layers and different versions of fear. You know, it's a question that we would ask in coaching in general. What would happen if your biggest fear came true? And then what? And then what? And then what? And what ends up happening as you have that conversation is you realize, it's not usually as scary as I thought it was most of the time.
I'm assuming you're directing that to white people.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. You're black.
I was just
follow
gonna,
that lane.
Yeah. I was just going to add, unless you are actually truly unsafe, you know, there is a difference between the two. And not even just white people, but anyone who is feeling uncomfortable with starting these conversations.
Yeah.
I don't think it's just white people there. I think there's a lot of people who are just uncomfortable with this topic for many different reasons. Now, if you actually truly are unsafe, that's a whole different story, right? Then what you need in that moment is totally different.
Yeah. I think I wanted to end with this conversation that brought me a lot of peace, I think, after being in a lot of anxiety about this, since we were talking about that. And again, we're going to just pivot for a second. It was between, of all people, Dave Chappelle and Maya Angelou. And one of the things she said was so profound, and it just kind of really hit me. He was talking a lot about, you know, her history when she talks about Malcolm X and Martin Luther King. She's like, yeah, Malcolm and Martin, they were her friends. And
she lived in the civil rights movement where, I think the way he phrased it, there were 9 assassinations in the span of a year or something. Many of them were her friends. And he asked her, "Aren't you angry? Weren't you angry?" He's like, "I think if I were you, I'd still be angry." And she said, "If you're not angry, you are either hard-hearted, like a stone, your heart is a stone, or you're really sick." But the trick is not to be bitter, because bitterness poisons the host. Bitterness doesn't hurt your enemies. And I think that really helped me a lot, because I was finding myself set off every 5 seconds by every little thing. And you're also watching the news where you just see a lot of raw emotion, and it sparks it sparks that up in you all over again. And I think that is the line that I'm trying to, tote, is how do I use my anger, get my anger to being productive at the end of the day. Yeah. So I just wanted to end with that. And I think you're right about awareness. That was a really good point.
Yeah. The anger piece also is like, it's just awareness at the end of the day, right? Like, how do you use whatever feeling you're feeling right now to move you forward?
Yeah.
In a productive way, to move our country and your community and, whatever worlds you're plugged into.
Yeah.
Forward.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, guys, we will see you next time.
And if you enjoyed this conversation, share it with a friend too.
Take care. Bye.
Bye. You made it to the end. Thanks so much for listening.
Don't forget to subscribe, and you can find us at boldtruelife.com/podcast or your podcast player of choice, including iTunes, Stitcher, and Google.
We would love to hear your thoughts on today's conversation.
If you like what you hear, please take 2 minutes of your precious time to rate and review.
It really helps us out. Thanks.